Greetings and good afternoon. My name is Tandisizwe Shimaringa, and today on Some of Us Are Brave, we take a cursory look at the lives of several women intimately involved in the fight for human rights and self-determination of African people. From antebellum-era lynchings to modern-day police terror, these sister warriors have used every means at their disposal to agitate and advocate for and to secure the rights of black people and all human beings who are oppressed. A look at Ida B. Wells, Kathleen Cleaver, Asada Shakur, and others today on Some of Us Are Brave.
May 2nd, 2005, the New Jersey State Police, with the assistance of the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation, announced a $1 million bounty for the arrest and return of Asata Shakur. A former member of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, Shakur was wrongfully convicted of killing a New Jersey State trooper on May 2nd, 1975, and sentenced to life. She was liberated from prison November 2nd, 1979, and now lives in Revolutionary Cuba, where she has been given political asylum. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, repression breeds resistance. To quote a line from a poem by Asata Shakur, "There were black people since the childhood of time who carried on a tradition of resistance." Resistance is not new, and neither are the responses to it. Character assassination, discrediting, isolation, imprisonment, and even death. But exile, to be driven from one's home, one's family, one's people, in many instances can be considered a social death far worse than the physical. Today we take a cursory look, and I stress that word cursory, at the lives of several women intimately involved in resistance to the oppression and repression of African people. For this, their, quote, crime of resistance, unquote, they have had to pay a heavy price, exile from their homes, their families, and their communities. In spite of this and other hardships, these women have continued to carry on the tradition of resistance. As an investigative journalist, Ida B. Wells' work documented the real motives behind lynchings and, in the process, the complicity of media in this terrorist activity. In this excerpt from her pamphlet, Lynch Law in Georgia, she speaks of the April 1899 lynchings of Elijah Strickland and Sam Hose, which had been called for and carried in the Atlanta Constitution newspaper.
During 6 weeks of the months of March and April just passed,
12 colored men were lynched in Georgia. The reign of outlawry culminating in the torture and hanging of the colored preacher Elijah Strickland and the burning alive of Samuel Hose, Sunday, April 23, 1899. The real purpose of these savage demonstrations is to teach the Negro that in the South he has no rights that the law will enforce. Samuel Hose was burned to teach the Negroes that no matter what a white man does to them, they must not resist.
Wells elaborates further in her work, Lynching, Our National Crime, as read by Elder Ruby D.
The lynching record of a quarter of a century merits the thoughtful study of the American people. It presents three salient facts. First, lynching is color line murder. Second, crimes against women is the excuse, not the cause. Third, it is a national crime and requires a national remedy. Proof that lynching follows the color line is to be found in the statistics which have been kept for the past 25 years. During the few years preceding this period, and while frontier lynch law existed, the executions showed a majority of white victims. Later, however, as law courts and authorized judiciary extended into the far West, lynch law rapidly abated, and its white victims became few and far between. Just as the lynch law regime came to a close in the West, a new mob movement started in the South. This was wholly political, its purpose being to suppress the colored vote by intimidation and murder. Thousands of assassins banded together under the name of Ku Klux Klans, Midnight Raiders, Knights of the Golden Circle, etc., etc., and spread a reign of terror by beating, shooting, and killing colored people by the thousands. In a few years, the purpose was accomplished, and the black vote was suppressed. But mob murder continued. From 1882, in which year 52 were lynched, down to the present, lynching has been along the color line. Mob murder increased yearly until in 1892, more than 200 victims were lynched, and statistics show that 3,284 men, women, and children have been put to death in this quarter of a century. During the last 10 years, from 1899 to 1908 inclusive, the number lynched was 959. Of this number, 102 were white, while the colored victims numbered 857. No other nation, civilized or savage, burns its criminals. Only under the stars and stripes is the human Holocaust possible. 28 human beings burned at the stake. One of them a woman and two of them children, is the awful indictment against American civilization, the gruesome tribute which the nation pays to the color line. Why is mob murder permitted by a Christian nation? What is the cause of this awful slaughter? The question is answered almost daily, always the same shameless falsehood that Negroes are lynched to protect womanhood. Standing before a Chautauqua assemblage, John Temple Graves, at once champion of lynching and apologist for lynchers, said, "The mob today stands as the most potential bulwark between the women of the South and such a carnival of crime as would infuriate the world and precipitate the annihilation of the Negro race." This is the never-varying answer of lynchers and their apologists. All know that this is untrue. The cowardly lyncher revels in murder, then seeks to shield himself from public execration by claiming devotion to women. But truth is mighty, and the lynching record discloses the hypocrisy of the lyncher as well as his crime.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. I mean every word of it. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset.
from Georgia and Mississippi, goddamn, we moved to North Carolina, where Mabel Williams and her husband Robert were leaders in the Monroe chapter of the NAACP, where they advocated and utilized armed self-defense against white supremacist terrorists. They founded Radio Free Dixie, a revolutionary radio news program, after they fled to Cuba.
We use the tactical demonstrations of nonviolence. We picket the swimming pool. We asked for one day in the swimming pool if they could not build one in our community. Well, just give us one day. And they said, oh, no, we can't do that. And Rob said, why? They said, we'd have to wash out the pool after you used it. So that's what spurred us to continue picketing for the right to swim in a tax-supported swimming pool. We had a 10-point program that we presented to the city officials asking for basic human rights, really, and they weren't about to budge because they knew they had the backing of the Klan and the state troopers and the federal government and everybody else. At one time, the Freedom Riders, who were down in Alabama, came in, asked if we would accept them to come in and demonstrate in our hometown to help us. Actually, they wanted to prove that nonviolence worked. And so Robert said, well, you can come in and we will protect you as long as you're in our community. But, you know, I'm not going out there because they know that I am not going to allow anybody to spit in my face or whatever and get away and live. So the Freedom Riders came into our community and supported us, and they had tickets, and we had one white Freedom Rider that came from England, and she was living in the homes of some of our people and picketing along with us. But the officials were calling for support from the Klan and everybody else. They were determined to crush our movement. So Robert told them, said, now wait, let's not, I don't think you should demonstrate on Saturday or Sunday, because that's, you know, when all these folks are going to be off work and they're going to be getting their beer and stuff, and this is going to be pretty bad. But they chose to go ahead and demonstrate on Saturday and Sunday. The city officials sprayed insecticide on the picketers while they were going around. James Foreman was there, and he was on the picket line. And when they got ready to leave, Robert had sent the groups of armed men in to bring them out because thousands of racists were surrounding the picketers, and they had begun to shout at them, to kick, spit on them, and so forth. And the police were on the side of the rioters. We were in our community protecting our community, but waiting for them to come back. And all hell had broken loose. People were really upset about what is happening to the young people who were on the demonstration line. And a white couple came into our community. And though Rob kept them from being killed, they said that they had been kidnapped. And then Rob got a telephone call saying, you caused a lot of trouble. In 30 minutes, you're going to be hanging from the courthouse square. So he said, come on, get the children. We have to leave. And we left thinking that we would go to New York, wait a while, and then come on back home, let things cool off. When we got to New York, there was a FBI bulletin, all points, saying Rob was armed and dangerous and schizophrenic and should be apprehended. And then at the end, it said he's traveling in the company of his family. So we left Monroe thinking we would go back, but he was on the 10 most wanted people list. And his poster was stacked up in post offices all over. Lots of people have those posters now. I understand they couldn't stay in the post office because people would steal them for a souvenir. But anyway, our family had to split up. And this is one thing about our movement. When we were in the South, we reached out all over the country and all over the world and created friends all over. Robert was a member of the Fair Play for Cuba committee, and he had traveled around speaking about the way the young boys in the Kissing case had been treated. So we had friends all over. We had to break up as a family in New York. I didn't see my children again until after I got to Cuba. Two boys, 9 and 11. I didn't see Rob again until I got to Cuba. But we were able to survive through that network of friends that we had created all over and eventually end up in Cuba.
Power to the people, black power to black people, brown power to brown people, and so forth and so on. When Kathleen Cleaver came to the Black Panther Party after being in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, she established herself in the party as the communications secretary early in their development.
A lot of stuff happened in the Bay Area. To make a long story short, Huey Newton was on trial for the shooting of an Oakland policeman and the wounding of another one. And the very small local group that had been called the Black Panther Party for self-defense was in basically a state of collapse when I got here from California. And I was saying, well, you know, you want to get attention on this case, you should have demonstrations. And we started having demonstrations in front of the courthouse for the leader of the Black Panther Party and getting press. And as the people came out of jail and came back, the party built itself again around this case, around freeing Huey, because we felt this issue of self-defense and the murder that we were subjected to was central to what was going on in the whole country as far as black people were concerned. We could take it from there, and we were organizing a movement to build a party all around the 10-point platforms, and the 10-point platform and the basic principles of human rights and social justice, but the focus was on that trial. The trial was scheduled to start around the 14th or 15th of April 1968. On April 4th, Martin Luther King was murdered in Memphis, where he had been speaking in support of a strike of the sanitation workers. So once he was murdered, the country changed. There was uprising starting in Memphis, going through the South, going through New York, going through just 200 cities went up in flames. Washington, D.C. was burning. In the Bay Area, Bobby Seale was actually in hiding because he had been getting threatening notes when he would go to court from the bailiff, say, you come to court, we're going to kill you, nigger. But we didn't know whether it was really the bailiffs or was it somebody else. And so Eldridge had said, well, you should just stay lay low. Don't go to court till we figure out where they came from. So there was a bench warrant out for him. Well, once King was killed, Charles Gary said, well, we have to, the Bay Area was very tense. I think Charles Gary, the lawyer, got the bench warrant withdrawn, and Bobby Seale and Charles Gary and some other people were going around requesting black communities in the Bay Area not to be destructive, in the, not killing, don't tear up your own community, don't riot. The Black Panther Party office in Berkeley, the headquarters had been moved across the Oakland line. People were jamming the office, asking for guns. They wanted to go out and start shooting. 2 days later, there was an encounter between about 50 Oakland police and 8 Black Panthers in Oakland that ended up in a 90-minute gun battle. I don't think the police knew exactly who they were shooting until it ended, it stopped. And it ended up they were shooting Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Hutton. And Bobby Hutton came out. They were surrendering. He came out with his hands up, and he was shot and killed. You know, just body was riddled with bullets. And Eldridge had been shot in the leg, and he couldn't stand up. So he was trying to come out. And neighbors in that area had seen what was going on, and they said, don't shoot, don't shoot, don't shoot. So he was arrested, put in, taken off to San Quentin. That's all April, weekend of April 6th, the same weekend that King was killed. Shortly after, he was released on a habeas corpus petition. And in Solano County, they said the parole authorities had not proved that he had violated his parole. They let him out on a bail. I can't remember now whether it was right before. I think it was right before that Robert Kennedy was murdered in Los Angeles. So this country is kind of off the hinges. Nobody knew what was going on. It was insane. It was crazy. So Eldridge was ordered to go back to prison. You know, this habeas corpus thing was overturned. He was ordered to turn himself in. And he said he was afraid to go to San Quentin because if he went to San Quentin, he'd be killed. That's where he'd come from. So he wasn't going to go to... In fact, he made a big speech and said, told everybody, he said, I didn't leave anything in San Quentin except half my soul and half my heart, and I'm not going back there. I'm going somewhere else. And he disappeared. He eventually ended up in Cuba. I think on Christmas Day, 1968, he arrived in Cuba. I tried to go to Cuba. I tried to join him. It wasn't easy. In fact, it never happened. I discovered after he left that I was pregnant. I wasn't run out of the country. I discovered I was pregnant. I wanted to be with my husband. And the only way, I mean, he wasn't coming back to the Bay Area. So I tried to go where he was. Now, the difficulty is that, you know, you're pregnant for a certain number of days. It's like a very specific timeline here. And I kept trying to go and trying to go and trying to go, and it wasn't happening. And so I finally just picked up and went to France and called up Richard Wright's widow, Ellen Wright, and said, help me, I want to get to Cuba. And I ended up being told that I should meet Eldridge Cleaver in Algiers. So I went to Algiers, and I met him there. And we stayed for 4 years and had 2 children.
Musical piece done by Sister Aisha Irungu, who we will be discussing shortly here on the Women's Magazine. Cimarron said to be a Spanish word for maroon, escaped slave. How appropriate. Charlotte and Pete O'Neill, members of the Kansas City, Missouri chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, have lived, worked, and organized primarily in East Africa since fleeing the United States in 1969 on bogus interstate gun charges. On the line with us now from Tanzania is Mama Charlotte O'Neill. How are you today, Mother?
Doing very good. Greetings, sister, and greetings to everyone who is listening.
Thank you so much for being here with us today. Can you tell us briefly your story?
Yes, I joined the party when I was 18 years old, fresh out of high school. I met Brother Pete O'Neill, who was the founder and chair of the Kansas City chapter, shortly after I joined. We lived and worked in Kansas City for a year before we left and ended up in Algiers. I'd like to point out that our community programs were very, very strong. We had the first health clinic, the Bobby Hutton Health Clinic. During that time, as you know and as your listeners know, the COINTELPRO program that the government had against the party was going really strong. A lot of the leaders of the party had been targeted. Brother Pete was one of those leaders who had been targeted, and after he received that bogus gun charge, instead of him going to prison, we made the painful decision to leave, and we actually planned to come back in 2 years, it was 20 years before I came back to America in 1990. Brother Pete has never gone back since 1970 when we left.
Now, that was a charge of carrying guns across a state line?
A gun across state line. And, you know, that was a new charge, a new law that the government had made. I think that law came about maybe 3 weeks before he was charged. He had just went to the Senate to expose Chief Clarence Kelly. He was doing some gun running in those days, and we had gotten evidence that there was some gun running going on. I'd like to point out, he became the head of the FBI later. And shortly after that, Brother Pete was busted, and he was given that charge of carrying a gun across state line, a gun that he was never found with, a gun that he wasn't charged with doing a crime with. But this was just one of the another ways that the government had to put the brothers and sisters in prison and throw away the key or kill them.
And you said it was a painful decision. You ended up staying 20 years before you came back. What was led to the decision to come back? And you, correct me if I'm wrong, you came back to visit.
Yes, but not just to visit. You know, in 1991, we formally started the United African Alliance Community Center. And each time that I've gone back in that time also was because of our Heal the Community program, which Brother Pete founded in the early 90s. This program targets at-risk youth, especially African-American youth, and tries to bring them here and show them a different way of life. You know, we live in a village here, and the African family is very, very strong here. And we know that exposing these youth to this different way of being, to this different way of life, can really cause them to look at their lives in a positive way and to go back to their own communities and try to turn the youth around there. So each time that I've gone back has been as a part of this program, spreading the word about this positive work that we are doing. You know, here at our center, last year we had 300 graduates. Right now we have more than 200 students. We're teaching them English, computers, health issues, HIV, AIDS, building construction, architecture, art and crafts. And all of the teachers are volunteers, youth themselves, you know. So this program has really been an example not only to Tanzanians, but to people all over the world. And this work is informed by the work we were doing as members of the Black Panther Party. So the spirit of the party is continuing right here in East Africa.
That's right. And even exile has not stopped you from carrying on that tradition of resistance.
If anything, we have become stronger.
Mama Charlotte, can you tell us how we can get more information on the work that you're doing there?
Yes, we have a website. It's www.uaacc.abari.co.tz. And I urge your listeners to go to that website and find out about the work and see what they can do in their own communities.
Mama, give us that website address one more time.
It's www.uaacc.habari, that's H-A-B-A-R-I, .co.tz.
Mama Charlotte, I wish we could be online with you all day, but we're going to have to do a couple of fund drives in order to make that a reality. But I do want to thank you for the little bit of time you've given us today. We're going to be calling you back in the future. Thank you so much for the work that you all are doing over there in Tanzania.
Thank you, sister. Thank you. All power to the people. And I enjoy talking to you.
All right, now. You take care.
Thank you.
To be honest with you, I hate war. forced on me by oppression. Otherwise, I would be a sculptor or a gardener, a carpenter. You know, I would be free to be so much more.
Reluctant warrior, speaking about why she continues to struggle. The name Asata means she who struggles. However, struggling does not always take the form of battle with the police.
The question of sexism affects political work in many senses. For example, I joined the movement in the 60s. And I participated in different organizations, you know, and since I was new and young and didn't know anything, I basically was happy being a gopher because you can, you know, learn a lot being a gopher, you know. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life as a gopher. And there came a point when I began to resent people thinking that it was my biological destiny to be a gopher. That's when it started to get rough. And I began to see that, you know, the sisters were the most efficient people in almost all of the organizations that I worked for, were also the most silent people in all of the organizations that I worked with and for, were also the most neglected, unlistened to group of people in all of the organizations that I worked with, and were also the most powerless people in all of the organizations I worked with. And the image of a leader was always male. Yeah, and when people would talk about leadership, they said the leader, he, you know, there was never any female counterpart of the leader. And it was, you know, I mean, it's something that we all as women have to face. You know, how do we make ourselves heard? As I was telling some of you yesterday, you know, you just could not be the human being that you were. Like, I couldn't be who I was because I'm, you know, like a little timid. Although, you know, there's this image, but I am naturally timid, naturally shy. I mean, to get in front of a group of people, you know, the first time I had to do it, I thought I was just going to literally die, you know, right then and there because I had been socialized to be timid. It wasn't just that my personality was timid, but it was the way that I'd been socialized. Women weren't supposed to get up in front of crowds of women. That was not an image that came easily to you. That was not something that I was primed for. So it was like, oh my God, you know. And I had to overcome that. And so that when you see strong women who are whole, you know, strong positions in revolutionary struggles, you know what they went through. It wasn't just that they didn't go through what men where the men go through half of what women go through to become effective political leaders. So I think the first step toward changing something is to educate. And I think that the first people that we have to educate are ourselves. And I think that we have to go through and identify the different things that as political activists women suffer. That the different things that women in our community suffer. And to start addressing those things, you know, systematically so that we have an analysis. If you don't have an analysis of the problem, it's very difficult to educate. So, I mean, the first thing for us to do is to, I think, make an analysis of where we are. We've made some progress. I mean, sisters are much more aware, thank goodness, than we were 10, 20 years ago. And we've got to start sharing that with each other, sharing that with younger sisters, writing about it, documenting what our struggle has been, and then trying to take it to another level. I think one of the problems that we have is being unorganized, you know, because there are a lot of ways that sisters can be organized. I mean, it's not just, you know, we can be organized in political organizations, and I think that's very important. But I think there's a lot of survival organizing that we can do. We can get together in terms of child care collectives, whether it's in terms of healing collectives. And, you know, by healing collectives, I've, you know, heard some very positive things about healing collectives and some very negative, you know, things that, you know, it comes to tell all and touchy-feely and cry all day. I'm not talking about that when I talk about healing. Collectives, I mean, I think it's important for us to get things that are in our systems out and some of the pain out, but I think that it's also, you know, that's useless unless we do something. You know, so I think that a lot, you know, healing has to do with activity. Otherwise, what's the point? Right. You know, you heal to do what? You know, I mean, to stay a victim? To damn your daughters to the same situation that you're in. So if you're not actively doing something, then I think that the, in terms of changing reality, then the whole healing approach to things is fraudulent.
That's a track called Exiled One, one of the many musical offerings of Sister Aisha Irungu, a dedicated and talented artist, a former school teacher and community activist, forced to flee the U.S. after continued harassment from the FBI for her activities. Aisha and her husband Bankole have been denied refugee status and opportunities to support themselves since fleeing the U.S. On the line with us now from somewhere in the world, Sister Aisha Irungu. Greetings, sister.
Greetings, sister. How are you?
I'm doing well today. Thank you so much for your musical offerings. I wish I could have played more of them, but I don't have your CD in my hands. But we're going to do that on the next show. You're a revolutionary artist, sister, but you're also a former school teacher. Can you tell our listening audience about this case, your situation?
Well, basically, it's a case of, like Asada Shakur says, it's a case of a person being persecuted for being a modern-day runaway slave. Our situation is a bit different than Pete and Charlotte O'Neill or Asada in that we don't have any criminal charges. So the whole thing against us is mainly the harassment for the cultural work that we've done in terms of trying to preserve and protect the African-American musical tradition, mm-hmm. as well as defend the human rights of our people. And we've been out here in exile for more than 7 years working and struggling towards having the culture preserved and the people's rights protected. And while we were in the United States, I have a family history of this, and Boncoli has his own history. But also we were, we won a case against the U.S. government on behalf of some black children in Charlottesville, Virginia. And those things just weren't liked very much. And, you know, we were forced to flee the United States. And I guess the biggest part, even bigger than that, is that we've been out here for 7 years fighting the racist music industry, fighting the corporations in terms of our people's rights for more than 7 years. And as you said, we're not even in the position of the people in the 60s and 70s. We've been refused asylum as many of our people are today.
Well, sister, Aisha, let me back you up for a second, because I don't understand what you're talking about. I thought the world loved black music. I thought everybody loves black music. Why on earth would y'all be persecuted?
Well, people have to understand that it's like Claudia Jones said. She's a sister who starred at Carnival in London. She said that people's culture and music is the genesis of their freedom. And, you know, that's basically what it is. What people are listening to in the United States and all over the world is this corporate version of something that's loops and samples, something that comes out of a computer, all the singers sound alike. And the whole tradition is being destroyed and it's being lost. And when you talk about this, you become the target of persecution. And in many of these countries, the jazz festivals are 90 or 98% white musicians. And most of them absolutely refuse to hire our people. So it's a case of where our people are persecuted for culture. And when we stood up against this in Canada, we had a whole refugee claim for our political situation, which was very lengthy and very detailed. And we had sued some people in Canada over some different things. And when it got to the point of suing these jazz festivals, we were told by the lawyer that if we continued our activism around the culture, that it would be played out in our refugee claim, meaning that we would be kicked out of the country for simply standing up for the culture. So, you know, this is really what we're dealing with, and it's not really anything different than what, like you talked about in the last show, Ida B. Wells. She was dealing with that in terms of the things that she published, and our musicians have always been persecuted. So it's really nothing new, but it's something that you know, that we're fighting for. We're fighting for it at the UN, and we fight for it everywhere we go. And we're calling on the people who are listening this evening, the African people in the States in particular, but people in the world, people of conscience, we're calling on people to support our music and culture through our firm, The Soulful Expression. Because, you know, otherwise there is nothing left for people to listen to except Lil' Kim and Missy Elliott. And that's not the culture of the people. So we're calling on people, as you were saying earlier, to do something concrete, and that is to stop complaining about the corporations, stop having discussions about the struggle of corporations, but support us in a concrete way, those of us who are doing something to uplift the people.
Now, if I understand your case correctly, you've also been denied gigs. You are a musician.
That's right.
And so as you are out there in exile, you have been attempting to get work as a musician,
right.
And you're being denied that.
That's right. We were denied work permits in at least two countries, which normally would have been a problem for anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not just the case with us. It's the case with anybody who is a person of conscience who is trying to take this music forward.
Mm-hmm. And you also recently had a petition to the UN. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. We recently did a complaint to the UN against the Canadian state. And it's not just an individual complaint for ourselves, but it's on the behalf of our people, because there's a big misconception in the world that our people have convention refugee status, and it's not true. We don't know of any case in the world where any of our people have ever been given convention refugee status, not any African people from the States or any native people. And so we want to have our people's rights recognized just as other people's rights are recognized. And we also want our culture protected as other people's cultures are protected, like the people from Palestine or Chiapas, different people. They have NGOs and different bodies at the UN who make sure that their culture is protected and respected. And even though we're 60 million people and people love our music, they feel free to exploit it, and because we have no protection. And the whole idea of the Canadian state telling us that we had to leave Canada and that we couldn't go back to the United States, of course, is illegal under international law. Mm-hmm. So we're looking to have all of those things addressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, sister, I'm kind of wondering, though, you know, with the globalization and migration in and migration out, and, you know, it's really, is there really such a thing as black culture anyway? I mean, you know, are you sure that this is what's really happening to you, sister?
What do you mean?
I mean, this isn't a figment of your imagination, is it? That you're being, you think maybe you're being oppressed or persecuted for some other reason?
Well, no. I mean, if you, you know, if a lawyer tells you that you're going to be, it's going to be played out in your refugee claim, and it is,
what can be more clear than that?
What's more clear than that? And like I said, if you look at the lives of the other people, mm-hmm. and I'm not the only person. There's also Sister Condi, who's right there in the United States, is dealing with the same things. Mm-hmm. And there's also a Sister Anita Bell. She's in Canada at this point. She sued the CIA over the drugs that were being put into the black community. She's mm-hmm. also filed for a political asylum in Canada as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not that. It's in any repressive regime, the artists, the musicians, and the people who write are going to be the people that are attacked.
No, I just wanted to check. You know, usually they tell the victims of repression that it's, you know, it's our fault or it's all in our minds.
Well, but that's in the United States because, it's not in the interest of any repressive regime or any oppressive state to admit that they're doing the persecution to the people, particularly in the United States where there's such a reputation of the country being you know, human rights leader and all of this stuff, but yet it's more of an apartheid state than anything, where you have a situation where the Native and the African people have never had their rights recognized. Mm-hmm. You know, the U.S. Constitution still has the black man listed as 3/5 of a human being. Mm-hmm. So it's if any other person who was a national minority were to go before the U.N. and they would say that this is the body of law that governs how my culture is treated, how I'm treated, that person would be recognized under international law. Mm-hmm. But with our people, it's a matter of the power of the American media, it's the military power of the American state, and also, you know, the whole issue of just the influence that these people have in the world. Mm-hmm. It's not in their interest. And, you know, and in terms of black culture, it's very difficult for people to see when they're in the United States. But the African people in the United States are an oppressed national minority. It's not black culture per se. It's African American music and culture of people of a particular group. Mm-hmm. Just like you have the East Timorese, the Palestinians, these people are a national minority. And when you leave the United States, you begin to see that very clearly, particularly when you come to a place like Europe or Canada where there are not very many African-American people. You begin to see that you have a very distinct culture, a very distinct language, a very distinct music, and that people all over the world feel free to exploit it because there's no guidelines and no protection. And so I guess that what I wanted to stress more than anything is that, you know, we want to call on our people and people of conscience to do something practical to aid us because Mama Condi, for example, in Ohio, she has fought tirelessly. Yeah, and she set up independent schools. You know, she's done all kinds of things for people, and now she's disabled. She's been accused of kidnapping her own children. And the situation that she's in is that she can't get food, she can't get welfare from the state, and there's nobody in the United States who's really aiding her. Mm-hmm. With us, it's the same situation. When we filed our petition with the UN, we tried to collect 500 signatures. We got 650, actually, mm-hmm. which was great. We got a great deal of support from Spain and French-speaking people and other people of conscience in the world. But honestly, only between three and maybe five people were black people from the States who even signed the petition, mm-hmm. you see. So, it's a situation where... Again, we're calling on our sisters and our people to do something concrete to support us, because when it comes to solidarity, it's always other groups of people who are supporting us. But we have to, you know, our people have to tune into these issues. And it, mm-hmm. it 500 years of oppression with the culture, with the music, with the language, with it, it's not a figment of anybody's mm-hmm. imagination.
That's right. Sister Aisha, how can we get in touch with you? How can we get some of those musical offerings that we heard today?
Well, the best way is to email me, mm-hmm. and that would be at soulful_expression@yahoo.com.
Okay.
And also, you can find us on the web. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of lengthy, but it's a website at GeoCities, and it's called Exiled One 2002.
Okay.
And that's Exiled One spelled out as one word. So it's www.geocities/Exiled One 2002. And again, we really call on and encourage people to do something practical to support, because it, you know, these kind of programs, it's great, but it has to be something that people are supporting an alternative.
Yes.
Because if people are not going to buy music from the Soulful Expression, if they're not going to support Condi in Ohio, if they're not going to support Anita, then you're supporting the corporations who are tearing the people down.
Right.
And, you know, we ask that people do something concrete to support us, because otherwise it doesn't mean anything. And actually what it does is it actually helps the enemy, because when you go before the refugee boards in these different countries and for the governments, you know, the illusion on television is that black people are doing very well in America,
right,
financially and otherwise.
Sister Aisha, I'm sorry. They're giving me the signal that we're going to have to cut this short. I wish we could have had more time to talk about all of these issues, but I wanted to do what I could for you. We've got your contact info. The CDs are in the mail. We're going to be playing them here. Thank you again so much.
Okay, we just
thank you for your work.
Fight the new cartel fraud.
Okay, thank you so much, sister.
You too.
You've been listening to Sisters on the Run. My name is Tunde Sizwe Shimoringa, and before I sign off for the day, I want to leave you with this resource list. Crusade for Justice is the autobiography of Ida B. Wells and is published by the University of Chicago Press. Ida B. Wells, A Passion for Justice is a 53-minute video documentary directed by William Greaves and available at williamgreaves.com. That's G-R-E-A-V-E-S. Self-Respect, Self-Defense, and Self-Determination are audio and video projects chronicling the life and activities of Mabel and Robert Williams, available from the Freedom Archives by calling 415-863-9977 or by checking freedomarchives.org. Negroes with Guns by Robert F. Williams is published by Wayne State University Press, and Radio Free Dixie by Timothy Tyson is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Kathleen Cleaver is the co-author of Liberation, Imagination, and the Black Panther Party, published by Routledge. She is also the co-founder of the International Black Panther Film Festival. For more info, check out PantherFilmFest.com. A Panther in Africa, a film by Aaron Matthews that tells the story of Pete and Charlotte O'Neill, was nationally broadcast on PBS last fall. It's available at apantherinafrica.com. Much of Charlotte O'Neill's artwork can be seen on their website at www.uacc.habari.co.tz. That's H-A-B-A-R-I. The Hands Off Asada campaign, in conjunction with the National Conference of Black Lawyers and others, is spearheading the effort to have the $1 million bounty on Asada dropped and her name removed from the Domestic Terrorist Index. Check these websites for more information: handsoffasada.org, asadashakur.org, and afrocubaweb.com. Her autobiography, Asada, is published by Lawrence Hill & Company. Soulful Expressions is an underground record label run by exiled human rights defenders and culture workers in the African-American musical tradition. For more information and to get updates on the case of Aisha and Bankole Irungu, check out geocities.com/exiled1-2002. My name is Tunde Sizwe Shimaringa, and you've been listening to Sisters on the Run.